Hello, my name is Joya Spadafora, and I am here interviewing Professor Anne Smart Martin. It is May 14th, and this is part of the Art History at 100 Oral History Project. Could you start out by telling us a little bit about your life and how you came to be at Madison?
I tell people that my life and career have been a crab walk, meaning that it's got some turns and shifts. But when you look back, you've actually come a long way down the beach, and it kind of makes sense. I was always interested in American history. I was always interested in colonial American history. That was always my interest. I actually won the state award for Virginia history, and went off to college to become a historian. I took a class in historical archaeology and was smitten. So when I graduated, I actually had a degree in history and anthropology and worked for every summer and for several years doing historical archaeology. And what that means is that these are places that have documents to enable certain kinds of analysis. So while I worked on some state highway projects, I also worked for Monticello, St. Mary's City, which is the capital of Maryland. And mostly I worked at Colonial Williamsburg, which was the restored 18th century capital of Virginia. So by doing that, I was very interested in the artifacts, and particularly in the ceramics. So that became my emphasis, is studying ceramics as artifacts. So at the time, material culture wasn't really a field. It was just kind of a academic idea that some people shared. One of the reasons I loved historical archaeology was because I felt you were getting at the everyday people, women, and particularly the enslaved, who had very little written record. But we could look at their homes and see how they lived, lifestyles, etc., and look at the power relations that way. So I finished up my PhD. I did it in May, but took a couple years off. Finished up my PhD. I was fortunate that a big material culture job came up. It was right then. And I had not finished my dissertation, but I was hired by the Winterthur Program, which is a co-institution of a museum and the University of Delaware, and it's kind of the center for the kind of material culture I do in the country. So I always laugh and say that I could get my shoulders brushed off from the dirt and become a ceramic scholar. And then I worked at Winterthur for a while and did some other projects, but because I was a ceramic scholar, then I could be an art historian. But I was hired as a material culture specialist and decorative arts. I'm sorry, I said that first. I'm hired as a decorative arts scholar, which is ceramics, furniture, glass, things that have utility, as well as aesthetics. So it's that decorative arts give you a continuum between useful and beautiful, and they're really good cultural markers for how style changed, how economics changed, consumer behavior. So they're very good markers. So, material culture, and I got a phone call asking if I'd like to apply for this job. And frankly, I got off the phone and I said, "Madison, Wisconsin, that's the home of the Progressive magazine." Because I worked in a state, I can say halfway between Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson. So I was excited to come to Madison, and it was a chaired position, and so we made the move.
And they approached you directly?
I did get a call, but that's not uncommon in a specialized field like mine to sort of reach out to the players. Since then, I mean, that was 20 years ago, the number of programs that train people in material culture, I've really exploded. Excuse me. Like I say, when I did it, it was I made up a field, so to say. And so that probably wouldn't have happened now. I'm just saying that there are lots more players people who are trained specifically in material culture versus a put together package.
And when you came to Madison, were there any expectations that were made to you about this position? I understand that it was fairly new.
It was a position that was funded by a foundation, the Chipstone Foundation, and that they were actually came from a fairly wealthy family in Milwaukee, Stanley and Polly Stone, who had a big collection of 18th century furniture, ceramics, prints, kind of the things that I do, I study. And so when they passed, they had wanted to have a undergraduate decorative arts program to teach. I think they actually went to Yale first, but then decided they could do it in Wisconsin. And so I was the first person hired in that endeavor, so that the expectation was a little fuzzy. Do I work for the museum? I mean, what do I do for the museum or the foundation? What do I do for the university? I mean, I was hired by the department. I am a UW faculty member. I mean, I have no real connection to Chipstone. But because they were annually funding me, and I was the first person hired, there was an expectation that I would work closely with them. So it was an interesting paradox, because they only promised they would do it for 5 years. And of course, you wouldn't get tenure until 7. So I had to be assured that that would happen, which I was assured that Letters and Sciences would pick it up. It was kind of a strange beginning, wasn't it? Sort of a university position, which had this crossover to public humanities and museum work, and we weren't really sure what that would be.
Was there any similar position or field of focus within the department already, but in a different context?
No one really did the American decorative arts. While I can say that the decorative arts it's not paper on the wall, it's not art on the wall. There's certainly within many fields, Chinese history, Japanese history there, where ceramics and other what we'd call decorative arts are the main, are one of the main items of study. So certainly people did study the decorative arts, but it was within the art canon. So no one had really done the kind of, sort of looking at the connection between objects and people in quite the same way. So it was new.
Did you find your colleagues sitting into your classes more, or being convinced to incorporate material culture into their classes?
It can be read both ways. In that material culture was kind of a not quite as accepted word at the time. Whereas now, of course, material culture is now the pedagogical term for what many people do. Both architecture and museum teaching and objects. So I think, at first I was probably, I don't remember people sitting in my classes exactly, but I was really warmly welcomed, certainly. The way in which I felt particularly welcomed is that, well, this is another long story, but I felt particularly welcomed. And over time, I think the idea of doing an object-based kind of study became much more common.
When you came to Madison, was the size of the department greatly different than it is now?
Yes. Yes and no, because we have lost some really critical positions. But that we've also added a few through different situations. We were able to add an Islamicist, Jennifer Pruitt. We were able to add India and other parts of the world with Preeti. So we've added some things, but we've lost some things. So architecture in a pure way is not really taught anymore. So I would say maybe it was similar.
Before you came to Madison, were you aware of the culture at all or how the school?
No idea.
Just that it was cold?
Well, the history department is world famous, right? So I didn't know much about the art history department, but so they had to really convince me to come.
Has there been anything about Madison and the department that has surprised you?
I'm trying to figure out where to place this other point, which is back to how welcoming it was. One of the things I was most concerned about, not most, but was certainly a pertinent point, was I had a 2-year-old daughter, and I had a very good situation of childcare, and had a great situation with my husband's work. We had a great situation. So when I came and interviewed, when I came back, Professor Geiger Gale actually took me around to childcare centers, which was quite humorous. And and everyone kind of gave her a hard time about it because she didn't have any children and she didn't know anything about it. But you know, she could smell the diapers and see the kids. So that was very gracious. So what did I learn? Something that surprised me about Madison or this department? This department was exceedingly positive and kind. I always felt they had my back. And I was never, because I had this odd position between me and the foundation, I really wasn't drawn into the politics as much of any institution. I had my own issues of trying to please the outside donor and the inside and trying to set up this interdisciplinary program, which meant that I wasn't quite as inwardly looking as some.
And how did you develop the relationship with the Chipstone?
How did I develop it? They came to art history with his position. And then I probably would not have taken it if Chipstone had not, even though they didn't hire me, absolutely not. They had nothing to do with it. But they did encourage me and kind of got in touch with me and encouraged me along the way. So because I was the first person hired, I think they had not really, they had a curator, and that's their only employee, but he chose to leave the summer I arrived. So there's a real hole. Meanwhile, Russell Panchenko, the director here, had asked me to do an exhibition of a Chipstone collection in the first year I was asked. So very quickly, I began to work with their collection, which is huge and nice, but there was no curator. So I did not know anything about the collection, anything about Chipstone, but I was really thrust very quickly into that. But there was no curator, there was no staff at that moment. It was not very well cataloged. I mean, it was just a whole different world than it is now. Now it's very, very nationally known for their innovative techniques. Their collection is beautifully cataloged. And so that's one way I worked with Chipstone right away, is that I did this exhibition, I think the second year, I can't remember, but it was really fast.
Would that have still been in the late 90s or around 2000?
About 2000.
So then when a new curator came in, did you get to introduce them to the collection or them introduce you once they had learned it more?
No, because the person that came in, because the old curator was still involved in that he published a journal called American Furniture. So he's still very involved with the collection. So the new curator, who was also, they're also the director, kind of, so they have this dual capacity. He knew his furniture, and so it wasn't that hard to, he was very well accomplished.
Did that change how you got to use items within the exhibition, or had that already finished?
It had finished. So, like I said at the beginning, it was kind of the Wild Wild West, and then I worked very closely with the administrator to select objects, and the old curator helped. I couldn't have done it without him. Even though he'd quit the position, he was able to come out and help me co-do it. I'm not really co-do it, but help me pick. So when the new curator came, he actually was a very old friend who worked at the same place I did, Colonial Williamsburg, for a long time. So things began to change as he got his feet under him. But I really didn't have to take that role of helping him.
So when you came into this position, you were obviously expected to teach and research and then also host exhibitions. Was there any difference in those early years as to now for how your time was expected to be spent between those different areas?
Absolutely, because I wasn't really expected to do exhibitions per se, because we did not have a relationship with the museum that made that happen. It's really not on a regular basis. I mean, there probably were some, but none come to mind. So, and I was also expected, I think, when I came in, to be far more a part of the Chipstone team. As I said, when people got their kind of feet under them and they started going a different direction, that I was not as integral.
Has your teaching load changed very much?
No, I was really lucky because I was working with Chipstone and I was developing this program. I was able to have a course release. So I teach three classes.
And presumably you had to plan all of those courses. There wasn't any that you immediately stepped into?
No, none at all. I mean, they didn't have the visual collection. Nobody had taught these courses. Probably what took over was building the the material culture program. So that became the big focus after 3 years or so.
And what did that entail?
It really was finding colleagues, finding interested people, kind of building a cadre, building a community. The community was incipient in that there were people who were active trying to do material culture and a few of them identified themselves as so. They were typically there was one in the history department, there was two in design studies. So Beverly Gordon and Terry Boyd and me and Jean Lee in the history department were the four horsemen of the apocalypse, I guess, and that we built the program.
And what was it intended to accomplish?
We quickly decided to do, at first it was a community, and that we could focus on teaching material culture. And relatively quickly we canvassed the university system, School of Design Studies and the School of Human Ecology, and art teachers in LMS. But we always said it was a co-managed program. That's turned out to be a problem in the administrative sense, because it's kind of cumbersome to have two different administrative homes. So what we immediately started to do was as we canvassed the ways this idea of this interdisciplinary consortia, the thing to do at the time was this odd thing called the certificate. You know, back in, it would have been 2003 or 4. Of course, they're everywhere now. I mean, there's just so many certificates. But at the time, that was a way, and we built a curriculum. So we had two required courses, and we had to come up with a way to create this emphasis.
And had this been the need for this program, had that been pushed primarily by staff, or was there a student call for it?
It was me. It was me that seemed like that was the way in which Wisconsin can be different and have a national, different national ranking. And it seemed like it was something that multiple people on campus were interested in, the museum community was interested in. I'm just trying to remember if there are particular students. I mean, particularly they took my classes immediately. I had a lot of folks take my classes. So no one came to me with a placard or a sign or a banner saying, please do this.
Were those early students primarily from art history, or were they also School of Human Ecology?
Both, yeah. And I think because we did the exhibition so quickly, we got to know people very quickly on both sides. That class was such a rush. You asked for stories, that it was such a rush, basically trying to do it in a semester and not having the connections needed, that we had two people in the class. One was in library school, art history in library school, and one was in art history, and they ended up getting married. And the joke for me always was that they were so miserable in this class that they had to bond with another to be able to get through it because it was so fast. And so we had both kinds of students, yes.
Has there been any change in this program as far as attracting or continuing to attract students?
I think a lot of it, the landscape has changed in two ways. One is that the field of material culture in two decades has completely become acceptable and interesting, and many, many people, many different departments kind of do this kind of object study. It's become acceptable to use objects as evidence.
Could you explain how they were not acceptable earlier?
Because it was a documentary world, right? It was a world where it was writings, and the cultural analysis of objects was really not part of the academic frame. It was in the museum world, but certainly not in anthropology. But there it just wasn't like it is today, where the study of objects is not only accepted but promoted. And I'll give you an example. When I was really young still, I was asked to edit the Journal of Record for Colonial American History. And it was a tough fight. They wanted, you know, a different kind of, the editor was quite hands-on, but he wanted a very different kind of standards of how you prove this point. In object study, you sometimes have to circle around. It's not a narrative. And it was just, I mean, it was something really unusual, and now that's not true. So I can see how the field itself has changed. But you started with how has it changed at UW, is that right? It's done everywhere, but it's not always done under the banner of material culture. And that it's big campus, and there's lots of material culture stuff going on that's not kind of under the umbrella.
Have you tried to rope some of those programs in?
I have. It's been a tough battle. Two things happened structurally. Of the four of us that started, three retired very early. So I was I always say I was pulling the boat across the mud flat, trying to get the attention on a big campus. And not attention, but the idea that this was an important thing to do if you are an anthropologist or a historian or in some other way. So there was that problem, which was institutional. And of course, the institutional part was when the university really cut back. And so these positions were not filled. This engine that was driving it kind of slowed. So we lost that momentum.
Have you been able to regain it?
I think so, in the sense that I worked for 4 or 5 years with design studies, and they were looking for a way to have a new center, but they weren't exactly sure how to define it. And I don't mind telling you, I sat with the dean at Zoe and explained what material culture is, because she didn't know, and it was the cultural study of textiles and objects. So now, and I was on a lot of committees, I was on the committees for the, this is all in Sohe, I was on the committees for, they have a gallery, I was on committees to start the center up, and it's now the Center of Design and Material Culture, which is really taking off next year.
But you've never held a partial position over there. Have you interacted with any other main departments?
It's interesting because I have faculty members on the faculty. We have a faculty committee, which is the university does have a advisory committee. And we do all the curriculum and do some projects. And those faculty members were distributed at the university. I'm not sure we actually integrated them fully in because, as I said, this was kind of a overarching idea, but each department has its domain, right? And not everybody in that department values material culture.
Since you've gotten to be so immersed within the School of Human Ecology, is it dramatically different than how you interact with in art history?
I would say so. They are a training school, and so they have to take design labs, and it has to fit into a complicated structure of classes. Not everybody here either thinks it's worthwhile, but I think that idea that it's a training environment and that cultural analysis of the past and the history of textiles or the history of interiors, because they have an interior section, a textile emphasis, but the idea that you're going to do the history of them is important, but it's not their sole mission. Not like the humanities, where your sole mission is to create, and not sole, but your major mission is to create and teach. No. The mission is to create knowledge and to pass that on in a creative way and useful way to the next generation.
You mentioned earlier that ceramics was your passion. And I know that Sohe has a very beautiful textile collection. Has that kind of shifted some of your focuses, or are you still a ceramicist at heart?
I always say that while you can love many things, that ceramics still makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. And I love textiles, and I love furniture. I love all those things. But there was definitely that keen attention that calls me. So they have a fantastic textile collection, and I work very closely with the textile person was hired a couple of years ago finally, and I was instrumental in getting that hire through. I mean, I didn't select anybody, I wasn't in the school, but I was instrumental in helping get that person on board. And get them landed, so to say. So I work very closely with them, and of course I love the textile collection. It's just such a magnificent resource. It's just not my primary area of study.
Have you been able to draw on other collections around campus, for example, the Chazens at all?
I use the Chazen a lot. And the reason partly is because I do student exhibitions, and that is something that has come more into a focus. And Tom Dale, my colleague, was the one that really got it kind of, and it was quite a contentious battle, frankly, to get Russell Panchenka to find a place in the museum schedule of exhibitions, even respect maybe for the student exhibitions. So Tom Dale was able to sort of craft a way in which we are kind of given one every year. And that changes everything. Because before I did exhibitions, I've done a number of exhibitions that were not in this once every year system. So, for instance, I did the Chipstone show, which turned out to be huge. I did a show with another big donor, and it was huge. In the big galleries here. And not, so these, I mean, I don't know the footage, but one of the huge galleries here compared to the small gallery downstairs on the court. And now it's going to be the Chazen building across the way. The Chazen. So I've worked pretty closely with them on a couple things. The exhibitions, I've done actually 9 exhibitions since I've been here. Student exhibitions. And I'll just go off on that tangent for just a minute. The first one I did was the Chipstone collection. I did one of the things that Chipstone has or had or purchased or whatever came into their collection is a collection of chamber pots from late medieval times to the early 20th century, which I love because it allows you to take an object and look at change across time. And it's a perfect sort of ceramic storyline of every kind of thing that's been made, high to low, you know, very simple. But also it shows you cultural things about kind of what size is it and kind of who empties it. And so it gives you that. But then that was done at the library because it didn't really come together here. We've done actually the big one was I do this work with account books, which is looking at the consumer behavior of people in the 18th century. And I knew a curator, the Smithsonian, and we decided to work on an account book in the Smithsonian collection. And I said, well, can I get my students to do it? And she said, sure. So one of my classes, we went through the documents and were able to pick out the things that we thought were very commonly sold. Then I and another student, 2 students, were able to go to the Smithsonian, go through their collections and pick out objects that we thought matched those things. And ultimately, I continued and did an exhibition. It's part of business history exhibition, which is there for another 15 years. So it's very exciting. That was my, you know, for the students and me, the students' names are up on the Smithsonian electronic thank yous. So I did that one. I did 9. See if I think I can remember them. I did last year. I did a really nice one that, because I do these student object study class as seminars, we're always looking for things to study. And so I basically started a relationship with Mount Horeb Historical Society because they had really terrific objects, but they really had not been studied. They had not been cataloged very, you know, it was just sort of what an historical society does, which often acquires, maintains, but not always having the money to or acumen to make it a collection, a standard. On the other hand, they started giving us objects we could use for classes to study. So I did that for a couple years. And as the museum got built, they built a new museum, my students and I were able to do an exhibition, the changing exhibition there from their collection, and do a catalog and do an ebook, which is a big thing on campus. And so that relationship continued. So that show is just coming down. And that was looking at ethnic expression. So a lot of it was, sort of Wisconsin ethnicity through time. So it was their arrival and different periods and the way these how it became, quote, Americanized, and how it became ultimately a tourist storyline. The troll highway, do you know that story? Through this little town, basically the highway went around them, and so this little town was struggling. So one of the things that they did, because of this big Norwegian heritage, big part of it, was they started out to have different sculptures of trolls in people's yards, and that became part of the identity and ethos of this town. So it's the kind of a troll expressway, and they were able to market themselves as this special place. Long way around that, because of this cooperative effort, I actually was able to win the Community Campus Partnership Award, one of the many, but that was exciting to recognize that. So that was a big exhibition, and last year was here at the Chazen, and there was a, you may have heard the name Frank Hurlbeck, and he has, personally was excited and enthralled by a particular kind of ceramic item, and this was something called the molded jugs of the mid-19th century. So this was a very common, it was like a jug on the table, but it was made in a particular way that was heavily molded so that it could become these really creative and beautiful pieces. They also had storylines on them, like what's the name of this? The Tam O'Shanter story, which was a big common story of the 19th century in Britain, about the guy who hangs out at the tavern too much, and his wife's always trying to get him to come home. He had to come home, but as he's going home, he sees some witches, and the witches start chasing him, and he's riding as fast as he can, so they stole the tail off the horse. But this is all depicted in these jugs, sort of molded storyline. So some of those were really cool. And so, long way around, we did an exhibition with his huge collection, from his huge collection. And I do mean huge, like 1,700 jugs. And that was really important for Professor Hurlbeck, which is his life passion, and that collection has come into the Chazen.
Was he able to view it before he passed away?
He was able to see the exhibition, yes. Yes, that was very exciting, and exciting for him. It was his life dream. So that was very gratifying.
That's lovely. With the student exhibition specifically, has there become a space that they're always able to use, or does it rotate?
There's a space. We've always been able to use the Meyer Gallery, which is on the first floor, which is a gallery off the main, where the policeman's desk is, whatever it's called. It's the court. I can't remember. So it's always been that on the first floor, that spot. I forgot the other big exhibition. Sorry. I did a FIG, freshman interest group, with a friend of mine, became a friend, was who was also interested in material culture. She was she's a historian of science, Lynn Neihart, and we had just started talking about what's on campus and how there are all these collections around campus. And because she's interested in nature and botany, history of botany, and I said, well, let's do an exhibition. So there's collections of botanical materials, zoological materials, there's engineering, there's all these objects on campus. So what we did was go to these different collections and kind of see what they were like and what we could use. And as a result of this, and the students did all this, we ended up, and they chose these objects, what they thought was good. And we came up with the idea of, you know, nature united all of this. And so it became a place where we talked about, where the exhibition included not only artwork, but also zoological, what would the word be? Taxidermy. So the models of study, there were pieces of scientific glass, there was art glass, and there were a couple of machines from the engineering school as well. And there was a 1907, maybe, camera when they were just starting, the big box cameras, and that was in the physics teaching collection. The physics teaching collection is a very early I was a phonograph, you know, phonograph in the case, very early. It was donated by I've lost it temporarily. Anyway, so we're able to use these machines. So there was, so we could get sound from 1920s from this one part. We were able to get something called a wave machine because that made the waves. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. It's like this system. You can press a button and they create these different waves, which are the physics, the physical capacity. And we had paintings of waves, and it was just truly fantastic because we used, it was the campus, it was a kind of Wunderkammer of all these very wonderful things, which we got from all across campus. So that's another real exciting idea. So you ask me, where do we start before I went off on the, oh, I remember?
I think a little bit about the museum space and changing as far as how students can use it.
So that it's, like many things, it's a box with two windows. And we were able to, and we had a designer. I mean, we didn't design all the shows ourselves, but we interpreted. We did all the labels. We came up with the titles and the, the interpretive different things. And we wrote. It's really a canvas that can be used in many different ways. And we were lucky to have really innovative, creative designers who were able to make things really work well. So it was a kind of an open space.
As far as teaching, you said that you have a pretty consistent number of classes that you have described the courses and built the courses. Has that changed with your teaching style changing very much?
The curriculum for the program has evolved into from a kind of 400 level seminar, but we wanted to be able to get students earlier in their careers. So we came up with a 200 level class, art history 200 level class, but this class is cross-listed in 5 departments. So it's cross-listed in history, anthropology, design studies, landscape architecture, be folklore, I can't remember the last one, so that we have an entree to students that they first arrive, freshmen. Ironically, so the idea is that we have this introductory class, then we have an upper level seminar where we were able to put those ideas to practice. So 200 and then 500. Well, of course, it doesn't quite work that way. I have a lot of upper level students in the 200 level class, and people turn up in the seminar that don't really know what they learned. And so in that 264, there's a graduate section. So that's, yeah, so I have graduate students, as many as 8 grad students at the height, which was like 2 years ago when I had 56 undergrads and 8 graduate students, which was a lot. It was a lot. And now it's different years do or differently, different times of the day, who knows? So it's down quite a bit.
As the program has expanded, have you gained more professors teaching or co-teaching these classes within art history, or is it still mostly Sohee?
It's still mostly me and Sohee. And ironically, and before it was Terry Boyd and different visiting faculty would teach. I had one person on the faculty teach who was in folklore, Julie Allen. She transferred away, or she was wooed away. So it's really been kind of me and different people in design studies. So the issue is that the reason we're able to co-teach is that the chancellor had put out a 2 senior professors from different colleges teaching together call, and they got the grant. And that grant has, or that the grant and the permission, I guess, would be to have this co-taught course, which has been going on for at least 15 years. But it's always hard to get 2 people in this busy time of cut funding, and they have so many of their own classes they have to teach. So this is the first year I'm teaching it by myself, which is really sad because it was really good to have these multiple perspectives. We have faculty come in four or five times a semester, a pair of faculty from different departments come in and talk about their research, and we pair two people that we think have different ways to handle it. One of them is an anthropology professor, and one is an architecture professor. So there are two different ways in which the landscape is part of this, one underground and one overground, both in Wisconsin. And the best one probably is the glass section, where we have a professor who studies scientific glass instruments and the wonderful glass artist in the art department. So last year we were able to go into the glass studio and see how scientific instruments are made out of glass, and then we're also to go see her work glass in her studio. So that was pretty phenomenal. The students, I loved it. It was phenomenal. So we have this really interesting way we visit collections. We go around campus, and we have these pairs of someone who does textiles this way and someone who does Yuhang, who's in my department, who looks at embroidery, particular kinds of Chinese embroidery, along with someone who does 19th century textiles. So always looking for that synergy.
Has this program brought any new professors to the art history department?
It did, in that when I first started, Chipstone funded a two-year visiting professor, and just by good timing, the American art professor had retired, and so that position was open. And this was Anna Andrzejewski, and she was able to take the American art position. So she came here to do material culture, particularly vernacular architecture, because that's another big arm of material culture traditionally. And so she was brought here to do material culture, and she's kind of gone a different direction, but that's just a different direction.
You've mentioned bringing students to SOHI, to the museum on campus, to different collections. Have you been able to leave Madison very much?
When I have a small class, we often go to the Milwaukee Art Museum. When I had an outsider art class, that's probably the most out and about I got. We went to Kohler in Sheboygan. The Kohler Foundation is a huge supporter of outsider art. I'll say outsider art in quotes, air quotes, because who knows what it's called. It's contested. But we also went to Chicago. We went to see the outside art museum. We went to see various structures and houses of famous people that are museums. And ironically, one of the big outsider art collections in Chicago is at the It's the House of Rock. No, the Hard Rock Cafe. Hard Rock Cafe. And the owner of that is a big collector. So we were able to visit Chicago and all these different sites and different collections. We were able to go in some houses that were not open. So it was pretty fantastic.
It seems like that's also continuing a relationship that other professors have established or also maintained, like Watrous.
Oh, yes. So obviously none of this would have happened without Watrous, of course. Watrous was very instrumental in helping get the Chipstone Foundation going. So it's a long history. So he had this vision, and Mrs. Tremendous Stone had to be wooed, and Mrs. Stone lived a long time, so several chancellors and Jim Watrous, all these folks, the joke was that they went to Milwaukee or Fox Point and put their feet under Mrs. Stone's table and had martinis, because that was something she did. So yes, Watrous was huge in making this happen. So we're very indebted to him. As a matter of fact, there is a graduate fellowship that Chip Stone particularly named the Chip Stone Watrous Fellowship to honor Jim Watrous, which I think is pretty cool.
As far as teaching goes, and with Watrous and the long history of the department, has there been any dramatic change you've seen since you started working here as far as teaching expectations?
Oh, teaching expectations? Well, I think it's like all teaching. It's very much more technical. I mean, it's much more technological. When I started, we were still doing slides, and I'm sure other people have talked about that. That, you know, you get your carousel ready, and it was just kind of a pain, but you know, you did it. And you had your list, and then you had to, you know, someone refiled them for you. But you did not have all these problems with malfunctioning equipment. Maybe you've heard others talk about that. It's just been, oh, in the new world, we're not, how do I put this? It's now very electronic. There's not slide carousels, so that there's so many things, more things that are out of your control. So part of it is different systems that fail. So this connection to the screen, I mean, that puts this up on the screen, you can't get it to work. Your laptop, you don't have the right cord to fit into the whatever's. So it's turned out to be a huge problem because the university doesn't really support it. So that's one thing. And the expectations are that you're going to be kind of tech savvy and have these really nice PowerPoints with all this detail. And I just laugh and say, well, I went from slides, which is a square on the screen, right? And then I put the square on the PowerPoint. Like, okay, here's the picture. But now, of course, the expectation is this, all the words and all of the things that I always thought you taught and out of your mouth. Instead, that's much more expected to be a visual extravaganza. That's what I say. So what else has changed in teaching? I think it's absolutely become more about money, absolutely about feet in the seat. And that's the university and that's the time. That we're really working hard constantly, particularly now with the new STEM interests and how the humanities has really suffered, that we're really working hard to get people to take our classes. And that's new. I mean, not new, you always want people in classes, but this absolute fixation on it, accounting, who gets the count feet under the seat. So I think that's very different. And there's the way money is accorded is far less, I mean, it's far more transparent, but not necessarily in a good way. In that each department has a budget, but that means your budget goes in the red if something goes wrong, or so it's not, so it's much more about can you hire another professor? You kind of have to find a way to make it happen instead of, oh, we will replace this person, which used to be more standard.
Are you worried at all if or when you retire that this position won't be refilled?
That's actually a quite current issue. What time is it?
It is 10:10.
Okay, we got plenty of time. It's kind of very much a current issue, it's an issue that has a lot of depth and a lot of quirks in a way. When I was hired, when this position came about, Chip Stone would not endow it because they wanted to have that money flexible. So for my entire time here, I felt, you know, I They give me a budget every year. I write them a budget that says I want this money for student buses or my travel, or, you know, so I was very lucky to have these other funds. But it was an annual commitment. And I always asked David Knox, who's the director, what's going to happen if you guys decide to stop funding me? And he would say, oh, Ann, don't worry about it. We love you. You're the best thing that ever happened to us. I'll give you a 2-year window before I stop funding you, you know, whatever you call it. And I'd say, David, do I need to bring out some deans or anything out here? No, everything's perfect. And again, I annually funded. He did have a concern that he thought that the university should pay more, even though I continually told him that the university pays as much of my salary as he does. So the Center of Design and Material Culture I was telling you about, which I helped to build, has a director's position and different strategic political ideas. So Chipstone has taken their money there. And I just found out a few months ago they're not funding me anymore, which breaks my heart. Because they knew that the university would have to fund me because I'm tenured. But they're going in a different direction, and they would just say it was a strategic pivot and timing is everything. So will the position continue? I would have said yes, but I'm not sure if that's true. Maybe something will happen. But if you're worried about filling a position that covers all of Africa versus the decorative arts, it might not be in the same playing field.
Is the Chipstone's investment in this new program more permanent, or is it also on a yearly basis?
I think what the dean of SOHI wanted was an endowed position. So that part of that means that a large amount of their capital has to go into creating this endowment, which is a lot of money. And so because of that, I think they were looking at other ways their resources could go in another direction. But I was not, I was not part of that process. What was that? You asked me about, what did you ask me about, particularly about the funding? The shall be continued. And I would have said yes, but I'm not sure.
Have you sat on any new hiring boards within your time in the art history department to kind of have a more understanding of the process?
Not as many as most people, I would have to say, because my draw has been so much toward creating and maintaining the material culture program. I'm sure they'd say I haven't done as much work as they did for the department, in that I was on some hiring committees, but I'm not trained as an art historian. That doesn't matter in many ways, but it might matter if you're trying to choose the best art historian for the position when there are so many people out there. But I would say has material culture changed the department? Absolutely.
So there's other components of service that you've done for the department?
Yeah, I mean, I've been on committees. I just haven't been on the hiring committees, mostly. But no, I've done plenty of service. I've been on the financial committees, I've been on the grad student committees, all those things. You just asked me about hiring, and I generally didn't do that.
Was there one that stood out to you that you've, of the other committees, that you've grown very, that you enjoyed doing in particular?
The committees? Oh.
Or just service to the department in general, I suppose.
I like doing the funding. I like trying to move the little things around on the board and make decisions. The merit committee, where you evaluate your colleagues' work at 5-year intervals, I like the grad student selection committee. Like many people, we don't really like having to do it over Christmas, as you may have heard. But you like sort of, you know, culling and creating a cohort. And, you know, fundraising. I mean, I've been lucky that I have found some interested alumni, or particularly the wife of a well-to-do alumnus who had a big collection of furniture as well, and I was able to get a small gift from her. I was able to get a gift from another foundation. So I've done a lot of that, and I think if you look at it, I've raised, not even counting Chipstone because I didn't do that, but I have raised $500,000 from the Kohler Foundation, and which is, we haven't gotten to that, which is graduate student support, and $300,000 from another foundation, and then these small things. So it's like a, you know, it's like a change. So probably $1 million. So that's kind of a little bit what I do, is sort of work tangentially to the department in some ways.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about the grad student support?
Oh, sure. It's another great personal story. When I first arrived in the very first semester, a woman came to the department and said, "We have this environment, arts environment in rural Wisconsin," and it was a building, the Modern Woodmen of America, the 19th century building, but inside it was filled with fantastic murals. So, and this is the Kohler Foundation, and what they do is they rescue and save these kinds of artworks, conserve them, and then look for an entity to take them over. So it might be a community, it might be a college, it might be a university, it might be a school. There are many different ways it happens. And so the question, would University of Wisconsin-Madison take this? And of course, what a dream. It was like I was a fairy princess, you know, that I just come, and now would you like this castle? And the castles were on in the murals. But it couldn't work. University required endowments, and they didn't give endowments, and you know, what did I know? So that went to Edgewood College. But I made a good friend out of Terry, you know, who was the director. And so when we were starting the material culture program, actually we had a retreat and we went to Kohler, and we were able to meet in the Balder House, which is a big historic building in Kohler. She was able to help us pay for hotels. We were staying at some side of the road hotel, you know, Motel 101. She said, "Well, if Kohler's going to be working with you, you should stay in a Kohler hotel." I said, "Okay." So I guess there's a baseline Kohler hotel. And then 2 days before, she called and said, "Well, there's been a mistake. Would you like to stay at the American Club?" So, but I mean, that's just a side story, because we're like, "Well, yeah." So we actually met in Kohler and hatched this program over 2 days. So that is one of the reasons that we're so indebted to the Kohler Foundation. And so at one point after that event, where we become so intricately tied to the support of the Kohler Foundation, which is their arts for nonprofit arm, she said, "What can I do to help the new material culture program?" And I said, "Graduate student funding." So every year they give a gift for graduate student project assistantship. Now it's become a summer award, but it's pretty exciting to have that connection. I was just there yesterday taking the new graduate student that's going to be working with them this summer up there to meet them.
And has that helped alleviate any struggles recently as far as filling or making TAs or PAs?
I've been so fortunate because I've had the project assistantship, which is helping with, LNS paid for it, so right off, but it's working with Chipstone, is how it was originally set up, and building the program. So I always had that. I had the Kohler Foundation Fellowship to help a crew. I had the James Watrous Chipstone Fellowship, Graduate Fellowship. So I had lots of opportunities to fund.
Do you think that support is how you're able to bring in more competitive students because they're being able to be paid?
It has absolutely that not having graduate funding is what keeps back a lot of people. And I've lost many, many material culture students who can go elsewhere. And I say that because we're kind of known as this sort of this, it's not on the East Coast where all the other sort of centers of material culture scholarship, one's in New York, one's in Delaware, one's now in Chapel Hill. But I mean, the point is that we're kind of something different, and people know the Chipstone Foundation, but I can't compete with University of Delaware, for instance, gives 5-year packages because material culture has gotten so much more universally worked on, I've also made it to Stanford. I mean, there's just all these places now where you can go. So it helps, but it's always within a framework. So it's not, my students don't get a lot more funding necessarily than other people. They just get it. There's packages, but my students have our students in American material culture, architecture, and all these ways just have more of a, there's more of a baseline they can use. But I've used the PA ship has not just gone to my students. The Kohler Foundation has not just gone to my students. They've gone to a big cross section of the art history department. So that extra resources have been completely able to support other people. So a long way around was your question about funding, right? So having those outside funds makes a huge difference.
It seems like mentorship is a big component of this well as far as attracting students. And I think a couple of other professors have spoken a little bit about mentorship within the department too. Do you want to talk about being a mentor a little bit?
To faculty?
Sure.
I'm just trying to think who was hired after me. I didn't really take that role when I first started. And after that, I was hired, I think Tom Dale and Nancy were hired within 5 years. So there's a real cluster of us. And they were all mentored by the senior faculty.